Om Mana Vyakya Prakatita Parabrahma Tattvam Yuvanam Parabrahma Tattvam Yuvanam Varashishtante Vasadvrishikanaihi Varashishtante Vasadvrishikanaihi Avritam Brahma Nishtaihi Avritam Brahma Nishtaihi Acharyendram Karakalita Chinmudram Acharyendram Karakalita Chinmudram Anandamurtim Anandamurtim Swatmaramam Muditavadanam Swatmaramam Muditavadanam Dakshinamurtimide
Okay, we're on verse 8. On page 19 in this little handout. Repeat after me. Vishwam pashyati karya karanataya Vishwam pashyati karya karanataya Swaswami sambandhatah Swaswami sambandhatah Shishacharya tatayva Oops. Shishacharya taya tatayva Shishacharya taya tatayva Pitrapudradhyatmana pedatah Pitrapudradhyatmana pedatah Swapne jagrati vaya esha purushaha Swapne jagrati vaya esha purushaha Maya paribhramitah Maya paribhramitah Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye nama idam Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye nama idam Shri Dakshina Murtaye Shri Dakshina Murtaye Sandeep Vishwan Pashyati Oops Vishwan Pashyati Karya Karana Taya Karya Karana Taya Swa Swami So Swa Swami Sambandhatah Shishya Acharyataya Tata Eva Pitra Putra Adi Atmana Bhedatah Swapne Jagrati Va Yaha Eshaha Purushaha Maya Paribhramitaha Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Namaha Idam Shri Dakshina Murtaye. The Sanskrit people. Third line. Eshaha Purushaha. This self, this Atma, with the Maya Upadi, this Atma, the self, the person. Eshaha, this. Purushaha, this person, who is really the Atma. Maya Paribhramitaha. Because of being completely deluded by Maya. Maya, right, Maya. Then Pari and Brahmitaha, Brahmitaha. Past passive participle, brahmitaha. Brahma means to be deluded. Pari means to be deluded all the way around. So, like to be drowning in the delusion. Right? It would be kind of like, say if there's a fish is in water, the fish in water is totally immersed in the water. So wherever, whatever direction the fish looks in, it's looking at the water. It's totally immersed in the water. So here, there is total immersion in this Brahma. Brahma means, delusion means the relationship to the world that is born of ignorance. In other words, the way that you're seeing or the way that you're relating to your experience is totally not the way it is. That's the Brahma, right? It's the putti means it's totally not the way it is. The way that you're envisioning or responding to this world is not the truth of the way the world actually is and the way that you actually are. Right? That's the Brahma. So that's what we mean by the delusion. So here, that person, the person who, because of this being completely deluded by Maya, and I'll unfold that more in a minute, being completely deluded by Maya, swapne, in the dream, in the third line, swapne jagrati va, in the wake, in the dream state or in the waking state, right? This person, this one, being completely deluded by Maya, then go up to the top line, vishwam pashati, this person sees this universe. Vishwam means the universe. Either in the waking state or in the dream state, this person sees the universe, experiences the universe. In what way? Karya karanataya, as being with differentiate the second line at the end of the second line, bedataha, as being as being differentiated. Beda means division. Bedataha, that taha gives the sense of the kind of the fifth case. It makes it an indeclinable. Sees the world as though divided, right? In the waking state, this person, being completely deluded by Maya, completely immersed in the Maya, sees this universe in the waking state or in the dream state as being divided, subject to the division. What kind of division? Karya karanataya, the division of karya and karana. Karana means cause. Karya means effect. It's divided by being full of cause and effect, being subject to cause and effect. Swa swami sambandataha, as being in relationship between the master and one's owner. The master is the swami. The swami can be the teacher, right? But the swami also is the master. Like, say, in a the master or the employer or the one who's responsible for you, the swami, the owner or the employer or the master. And then you're swa, my swami. Right, so there's a relationship, the relationship between between the employer and the employee, between the master and the servant, you know, between the teacher and the student, as though they have that one, so it's not going to be teacher and student. So between the master and the servant. Then also, or sishya acharyatya, or there's the difference of teacher and student. Sishya is the student, acharya is the teacher. So there's a difference. You see the difference between teacher and student. The universe is divided in that way. Similar to ta eva, similarly, pitra putra adi atmana, as being the self in the form of the father and son, or by the nature of father and son. You could say mother and daughter also. So within the world, all of this type of, we're subject to all of these dualities. Cause and effect, master and servant, teacher and student, father and son. Okay. So the Atma, the self, being totally deluded by Maya in the waking state and in the dream state, experiences oneself within this duality. So here it goes, salutations to my teacher, right? In the form of my guru. Salutations to Dakshinamurti, Sri Guru Murtiye, in the form of the Lord Dakshinamurti, who removes all of this ajnanam. Who removes this ignorance. Whose self is deluded by this Maya in the waking and dream state. What's so interesting about salutations to my teacher, whose self is totally deluded by Maya in the waking state and the dream state, right? Seeing this universe, right, seeing this universe as being subject to, the one who sees this universe in the waking and dream state as being subject to all of these different forms of duality. So it's a beautiful verse, really. So let me just go through this. If you have Maya under your control, there's no delusion, right? For instance, Maya is what's responsible for the projection of all of duality, space, air, fire, water, earth, and everything that's in it. So when Maya projects the universe, projects this whole time-space universe that we objectively experience, this kind of shared duality that we have. But for you as an individual, you're projecting Maya all the time. If I ask you to imagine a meadow, or if I ask you to have a memory of something, right? If I ask you to remember what you did yesterday, to just imagine that imaginative capacity is what we call Maya. You have it in a limited degree, what the creation has in a total degree. And so now, if I ask you, see the difference between these two things. If I ask you right now to imagine a meadow and fill it in with all kinds of detail, you can just close your eyes or leave your eyes open, and you can imagine it. You can imagine that meadow. I can ask you to put some people in it, to have the birds and have birds in it, have animals in it, see the clouds in the sky, see the sun. You can enjoy this imagination, and it's something that is your, what we call your glory, your vibhuti. You are the Mayavi. Mayavi means you have that Maya under your control, right? You are the Ishwara, you are the Lord of that meadow imagination. That's what we call Mayavi, the one who has the Maya under their control. In this case, when you're imagining the Maya in that way, you're not deluded by the Maya. But you're the Mayavi. You have the Maya under your control. Now, it's different if, for instance, you're just sitting and you know, find yourself engaged in a daydream. You haven't asked to have a daydream. You're having a daydream. That's two different things. In one instance, I am the Mayavi. I have the Maya under my control. In the other instance, the Maya is taking place without any act on my part. And then I find myself often, I'm not even talking about dream, I'm just talking about daydream. I am now a character in the daydream. See what I mean? It's not like I'm having the daydream. The daydream is taking place, and I'm a character in the daydream. And as a character in the daydream, I'm not thinking that I'm having a daydream. I'm just simply in the daydream. And I'm experiencing the daydream from within it, from the standpoint of the jiva, of the individual within it. Now the same thing happens if I have a dream at night, unless it's a lucid dream. The dream is taking place, and more often than not, I'm a character within the dream, experiencing the dream from within it through my sense organs. Okay? So we'll just use the dream for a minute versus the Mayavi. If I'm projecting the meadow, even if I put the characters in the meadow, and even if I decide to take a form in the meadow, as long as I'm not lost in, once I take a form in the meadow, as long as I don't get lost in the form, right? If I don't get lost from the standpoint of the form, but I'm aware of having taken a form in the meadow, there's no Brahma. There's no delusion at all. Mm. That's just what Ishwara situation, which is the Atma, the self, plus the manifestation of infinite knowledge. There's no delusion. There's nobody, there's no Ishwara, the one who's identified with the whole Maya Upadi, the whole Maya conditioning, the whole manifestation of the creation that takes place in consciousness. From the standpoint of Ishwara, there is no delusion, there's no agnanam, I am the whole. I am the whole and I am free from the whole. Just like when you have, from your standpoint, if you have an imagination of a meadow, you are the meadow and you're free of the meadow. Both things are there. The meadow comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. At the same time, I am the meadow and free of the meadow. Right? Now, even in terms of your thought, if you take the thought, look at the thought as Maya. If I have a thought, like say if I ask you just to have a thought of a tree, have a thought of your favorite tree. Okay? You have the thought, so now you've created the thought, you've brought the thought into consciousness, right? And now I say, okay, don't get rid of the tree thought and have a flower thought. The tree thought is gone, replaced by the flower thought. Now I say, give up that exercise completely. It's fine, it's just an exercise. You have a thought, you know, you're aware of the thought, and you get rid of the thought. You aren't lost in the thought. Okay? There's no being lost in the thought. So there's Maya of you there. That thought is under your control. There's no Brahma there. But now let's look at this. There are thoughts and there are thoughts. Say I have a thought that is an emotion. Can I just have the emotion? Because emotion is a thought, right? Just like any type of thought, emotions come and go. Right, I have this emotion, you know, or I have an emotion-laden thought. Say I have an emotion-laden thought. Does the thought come and go? Or is there Brahma there? What is Brahma? The Brahma means is that I'm lost in the thought. You see what I mean? It's no longer just a thought that's come and gone, that comes and goes, like most thoughts. For you and your with your mind or with your thought flow, most thoughts are coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. You probably have thousands of thoughts a day do you have that are simply coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. There's no one who's engaged with that thought or lost in the thought. But then there's thoughts that are coming, and now it's not that's a thought that's coming and going. I no longer have an objective relationship. There's a Brahma that's taking place there. Now that's just on the level of the thinking mind. This is on a bigger level than that, but what I'm trying to make you aware of is what we mean by Maya. Maya that we talk about in reference to the whole infinite creation, we're also talking about it in terms of your subjective experience. This creation is your objective experience. As this objective experience, you find yourself as a jiva within it, looking around in it, experiencing this creation from within it. That's our situation here in the physical creation. With me, we're experiencing this physical manifest creation from within the creation. Okay? Experiencing it from within the creation, right? I look around and up and down and backwards and behind myself. In all the totality of my experience, the totality of the experience that I'm having as an individual within the creation is like a fish in water. In other words, wherever I look, and to whatever degree and with whatever intensity I look, I am looking within the water. I am looking within the creation. Now, this is true even when I'm using my sense organs and looking at my own body and my own sense organs and my own mind, the one that's looking, right? If I look at my body and my sense organs and my mind and say I analyze my mind and I analyze my thoughts and I analyze my emotions and I analyze my sense organs, I'm still looking at those things that exist within the creation. Your mind exists within the creation. Your sense organs, your physical body exists within the creation. Your emotions exist within the creation. The I thought exists within the creation. These are all the things that exist within duality. Now, just to make sure, if you have a meadow imagination, from your standpoint, you're the self from whom the entire meadow comes. You're not looking at the meadow from within the meadow. Right? The whole meadow is existing in you. But what about the characters in the meadow? Say you've put, I ask you, put a bunch of characters in the meadow and have them walk along the path and whatnot. Now have what character, the one of the characters, look out at the meadow and at their friends and look up and look down and look at their own body and look at their own sense organs and look at their own mind. The character in the meadow is in our situation. What the situation I am in right now is the situation that the character in the meadow is. The character in the meadow has this paribrahmitaha. It's completely deluded by the maya, which is the very material that projects the entire meadow. So what I'm saying is that this universe, which includes the body, mind, sense organs, right? The universe, it's not that the body, mind, sense organs that makes you an individual comes from somewhere else. It is within the universe. And if it's because it's within the universe, it's like a fish in water. And everything about it, you know, that exists within duality, like the body and the heart and the tissues and the blood, everything that makes this physical body exists within the universe. Everything that makes up your mind exists within the universe. All of your sense organs, all of your thoughts, even the I thought, all of your memories, all of your emotions, all of your complexes, all of your traumas. There's absolutely nothing in your experience that is outside of that maya projection. So the delusion is absolutely total, because it's absolutely total for that individual, because for that individual, the totality of the experience is more maya. You know, whatever the experience is maya. As long as the experience that you're having is something that is objectifiable. Right? Like here, from my vantage point, you are all in maya, right? Because you're part of the universe. You're something that I'm experiencing. And I'm the subject from my standpoint, you're the subject from your standpoint, and you're all the object, right? But then say I can look at my body and I say, well, I'm the subject, and my body is now the object. I'm still not out of it. But I can look at my own sense organs that are looking at the body and say, well, you know, my sense organs I'm aware of. And they are, because of them, I'm perceiving the body. And then I can look at my mind and say, well, my mind, I'm aware of that. And because of my mind, using my sense organs, I'm perceiving the body and I'm perceiving you. And then I can study the mind. Well, the mind has these kind of capacities for thinking or for getting upset or, you know, for resolving problems and do all kinds of psychology, all kinds of analysis. But everything that we're doing is still within, you know, the creation. It's still within the dream. And so the delusion is total. It's not like I can look at some part of this creation, you know, and have it be free of delusion. Because there's no part of my experience at all that is free of maya. As long as it exists within the world of time and space and objectification. Objectification means simply I can be aware of it. There's a subject-object relationship. Now look at this. Even if we're saying, well, you know, what about the guru-sisha relationship? The teacher-student relationship, that certainly should be outside of maya, you know? Wouldn't that be outside of maya? I mean, it's supposed to liberate us. It should not be in maya. Well, imagine yourself, imagining the meadow. And you put some people in the meadow and you throw a few mumukshus in there, in the meadow. A few people that are really desirous of liberation. And then you, in all compassion, you think, let's give them a guru also. So you throw a guru there into the meadow. And now the guru, and a real guru, not a fake guru, a true guru, someone who really knows. Now that guru, so the that guru is going to teach those students in the meadow. Now, does that mean, does it mean that the students aren't part of the meadow and the guru is not part of the meadow? What if you withdraw? Here, this, just imagine this. This is kind of sad in a way, but it's a sad little imagination. But here's all your students, the students, and there's the teacher. And this knowledge is just starting to take place. The teacher is starting to sincerely teach those students. And then the alarm goes off or something, you have to do something, and so you just end that imagination. What happened to that teaching? What happened to that guru, and what happened to those students? They go with the imagination. They're all part of Maya. Totally. And here, do you think that we're not all part of Maya? Here's this wonderful teaching going on. Here's the students and the teacher and the Vedas, the Upanishads. This very sacred knowledge all is taking place. Is there some part of the whole thing that's not Maya? There is something that's not Maya. But the only thing that is not Maya in what's taking place is what that teaching is pointing to. It's what the teaching is pointing to. Not anything in the world of names and forms, and in the world of cause and effect, in the world of duality. You know, in the world of relationship, when they say that swaswami, you know, that swaswami sambandhataha, that just means the relationship between people. You know, like the master and servant, or employer and employee, or when there's an unequal relationship. All of these relationships take place within duality. Of all of these relationships, there's the father-child or the mother-child. That's a very sacred relationship. That's fraught with reality, right? What's more fraught with reality than the relationship between a parent and child? I mean, so organically real, you know, it just twists your emotions like anything, both positively and negatively, painfully and joyfully and painfully. You know, but the mother and child and the father and child, they're also part of the meadow. They're also existing within the water. They're all existing within the water of the creation. There's no way to get out of it at all. There is a way, though, between teacher and student. That's totally Maya also. There's not one bit of it. The Vedas are Maya. The Upanishads are Maya. The teacher is Maya. The student is Maya. The bondage is Maya, and moksha is Maya. That's really getting... That's the Mandukya Upanishad. The bondage is Maya, and your moksha is Maya also. Teacher is Maya, student is Maya. Your Upanishads are Maya, the Vedas are Maya. All teaching is Maya. And the teaching, the Maya teaching, is meant to remove the Maya bondage from the Maya Sisha. So the Maya Guru is removing the Maya bondage from the Maya Sisha to give that Sisha moksha. But how does that take place? You know? So the salutations to my teacher who knows all of this. Okay. So now, just think about this. Let's go back to the meadow for a minute. You are the Mayavi. You are the one who wields the Maya for the meadow, in the meadow imagination. So now, the truth of the meadow is really the sat-chit. It's the truth of the meadow. I could even say the self of the... You are the self of the meadow. The meadow imagination is totally dependent on you for its being. You are the consciousness, the knownness that the meadow enjoys, and you are the being that the meadow enjoys, the whole meadow. You're the Ishwara of the meadow. Now, you can say, yes, I am the self of the whole meadow. And I ask you, if you are the self of the whole meadow, because the meadow comes from you, is sustained by you, and goes back into you, resolves into you, and it really has no being apart from you, right? Because where does it go? It doesn't have any separate substance. You are its very being. So the meadow comes from you, sustained by you, resolves into you. Now here's the meadow. Say the meadow is there, and you put some people in the meadow. You are the self of the whole meadow. True. If you are the self of the whole meadow, does that mean that you are the self of the grass? Are you the self of the trees? Are you the self of the birds? Are you the self of the people in the meadow? Like, just think about it. In the meadow, each person in the meadow, if you were to ask them who they are, if they were to speak rather oddly, they would say, well, I am a conscious, existent being named so-and-so. Right? I am conscious, I exist. And if the little bird could talk, yeah, I'm a conscious, existent little bird. You know, and the grass would say, I'm conscious, existent grass. And the stone would say, I'm conscious, existent stone, but I can't talk. You know? The thing is that there is nothing, nothing in the meadow that is away from conscious, existent being, which is me. Now, what is a little different from the stone and the people? It's kind of like this. If I, in the meadow world, if I hold a stone up to the sun, and I hold a mirror up to the sun, right? Both are so-called inert, right? The mirror is inert. The stone is inert. But the stone is illumined by the sun. The mirror is illumined by the sun. It's lit up by the sun. If the sun wasn't there, they wouldn't be illumined. The stone is warmed by the sun. The mirror is warmed by the sun, right? But there's this little difference that the stone doesn't reflect the sun. The mirror, by its material, reflects the sun. Right? But both are equally illumined, equally warmed by the sun. The sun doesn't have a preference. I'm only going to illumine the mirror, and I'm not going to illumine the stone. It doesn't have any such preference. I'm only going to illumine and warm up the sun, the mirror, and I'm just going to leave the stone out completely. No, there's no such thing. It's the same when you have the imagination of the meadow. There's nothing in the meadow that enjoys less being than anything else. Everything is equally being. Everything is equally consciousness. But some things enjoy what we call a subtle body. Even plants, any living being, plants and animals and humans, you know, seem to reflect consciousness where, you know, stones and dead things don't. That's what gives us this illusion. Like, look at here, here we are, in the meadow of this room. And you'll all say, well, I'm a conscious being, but the rug isn't. It's true, the rug isn't. This isn't. So we have little pockets of consciousness, you know, and then we have, you know, chair and rug and table and computer. All of these things don't reflect the awareness. Right? And so we think there's a difference. Some things enjoy awareness, some things don't. But actually, if you think of it in terms of the meadow, all of the things equally enjoy, if I say it like this, being, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is. I happen to say it for myself, I am, and I call you, say for you, you are. And I say for this, it is. But I might as well say the whole thing am. But the whole thing am. There isn't any am is. Or am are. The whole thing is, or am. My amness is the isness that the whole thing enjoys. Now, not only that, absolutely everything that I experience is known. Everything. And this is, I think, this is how you finally get freed from this notion of limitation. Think like this. I'll use the word conscious. I'll start with conscious. I am conscious of this and 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 this, 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 this. I'm conscious of this body. I'm conscious of my sense organs. I'm conscious of my mind. I'm conscious of all that is. Right? And so if everything that I'm conscious of, if I'm conscious of all that is, in my experience right now, all that is that falls into consciousness includes my body and my sense organs and my mind. Not just everything from here on. So another way of saying that, this is known, instead of consciousness as a synonym, I'm going to use knownness. This is known, this is known, you are known, this is 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 known, the body is known, the sense organs are known, the mind is known, the thoughts are known, the emotions are known, the I thought is known, there is nothing that's not known. You know? So, that is the situation, actually, is that the bottom line of all experience is knownness. Right? And you have to recognize that this body, mind, sense organs has to belong to the universe, which is illumined by that knownness. Or this body, mind, sense organs has to be recognized as objective and illumined by the consciousness which I am. There's that break that has to take place. If that doesn't take place, then I'm have this problem of paribrahmataha. I am the fish in water. Right? I'm the fish in water looking at the universe from within rather than recognizing myself as the conscious being, right? That is the luminary, the one, the conscious being which the whole universe enjoys. And so now here in the guru-sisha relationship also belongs within this duality. The guru makes you who are within the meadow, within the creation, recognize that the conscious being that you are is the one that is the conscious being that illumines the conscious being that you are, that illumines this body, mind, sense organs, moods, emotions, thoughts, I thought, that this me that illumines all this is the same me that illumines the whole. That's what has to be recognized. That's what the teacher points out to the student. Maya is left behind. Right? If I tell you, if I reveal to you who you are, I'm revealing to you the one from whom the whole meadow has come. Right? The self that's not an object within the meadow. The self that's not an object within the creation. Whatever is within the creation belongs to Maya, but you're not an object in the creation. If you take yourself to be an object in the creation, then you're the fish in water. Then there's that paribrahmataha. And this is our situation. You find the situation for yourself in the waking state, it's jagrat, you know, and in swapna, and in dream. It's a relationship of yourself as an individual within the creation that you take completely for granted, because everything about you, the body, mind, sense organs, everything that makes you an individual is part of that system, is included within that system and is part and parcel of the system. In order to gain knowledge, you have to recognize that innermost self, the conscious being that you are, that is not an object within the system. Once you differentiate that self from the time and space and everything that you experience, then that self, not being able to be an object within the system, can't be differentiated. In other words, the conscious being that you are, and the conscious being that you are, and the conscious being that I am, if it is not an object within the Maya, within the creation, then what's to make my consciousness different from your consciousness? I become the one from whom the whole has come. I'm not limited by any object that's within the world of objectification. So I'll stop there. I'll probably have to do a little bit more next week, but I'll stop there for now. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudarachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Could you explain a little bit more about how you can't find consciousness in the creation?
Oh, I didn't say you can't find consciousness in the creation in that way, because there's nothing but consciousness. But you can't find it as an object. So you can look around, where's the consciousness, where's the consciousness? You know, it's not something that you can objectify or have a relationship with. But at the same time, the consciousness is self-evident. You know, because you can say, I'm a conscious being, but then if I ask you, well, show it to me. You can't show it to me, you are it. And there's not going to be a consciousness underneath it, illumining it. And that would be an infinite regress. It's like there's a consciousness, illumining consciousness, but there's nothing between. There's no difference between the subject and the object for consciousness to illumine the second thing, consciousness. But the sense is that I'm aware of consciousness. You are aware of consciousness because consciousness is consciousness. That's why we say it's self-evident, self-shining. It's like the sun. You know, the sun is luminous. You don't have to bring in another sun to light it up. It is the source of light. So consciousness is the source of consciousness. And so it is its own self-evident experience that doesn't require subject-object, nor can you objectify it to look at it.
So you can't find it as
not as an object, but in there is no experience that's devoid of it. Try to have an experience. Any object, any emotion, any thought, you know, any imagination. You know, even when you meditate and you try to shut all of that down, right? There is only consciousness. In fact, it's the same thing with existence. You never have a situation or an experience free of being. You can try to get rid of everything, and we do this in meditation. You withdraw your mind and your sense organs from all objective experience. And the more you withdraw, the more what is left is being. Being which is consciousness. Self. So when you say being that is consciousness, you can say like this, self-evident being. That's kind of nice. Self-evident being. It means the being which is self-shining, which is consciousness. What's nice about using a term like self-evident being is that when we say consciousness or awareness, we usually use the word to think of consciousness of something. Like, oh, I'm conscious of that. I'm aware of that. We use consciousness in terms of subject-object relationship rather than just self-evident being. Yeah. Consciousness isn't a knower. If consciousness was a knower, then you can never be without knowership. You are without knowership. In deep sleep, in samadhi, you know, in meditative, and when you totally resolve the mind in meditation, there's no subject-object relationship. There's no consciousness of something. There's not even anybody saying there, oh, look, I'm in samadhi now. There's no duality, subject-object duality isn't there. You need sense organs and a mind for subject-object duality, and that all belongs to the creation. That all exists within the creation. In the Mandukya Upanishad, you know, Swamiji often says, the dream, understanding the dream, and dream you can also use your imagination, daydream or dream. It's really the Achilles heel to the reality of the world. Because we have this drishtanta, we have this example where you can actually be within a dream universe, and of course from the standpoint of you as the one within it, it seems so real, like the dream character can go, how can you say this isn't real when it weighs, you know, 20 pounds? How can you say it's not real when I pinch myself and it hurts? You know, doesn't that make this real? Well, there is a relative reality. You know, within this creation there's a relative reality, an empirical reality, a shared reality. But there's not an absolute reality, you know. Just because I pinch myself and it hurts doesn't mean... It's not saying that I pinch myself and it hurts. We agree to that. But that doesn't mean that it's an absolute reality, you know. And so if you can hold the dream experience next to the waking state experience, why is one more real than the other? Really, from within itself. From within, if I'm analyzing the dream from in the waking state, I can say, like Swamiji laughs, sometimes he'll say, well, this is a bigger joke. I mean, this is a bigger, more solid, longer lasting illusion. But if I hold the dream, the waking state versus the dream state, and I'm looking at it from the standpoint of somebody within, you know, both the dream character says, this hurts, this weighs 20 pounds. The waker says, this hurts, this weighs 20 pounds. How can you say this isn't real? Here I am and I'm looking at it, you know? Well, it's because the one who's looking and what you're looking at are both Maya. They both enjoy the same order of reality. And so this is as real as this. Right? But these two enjoy the same order of reality, and that order of reality is Maya. So within that order of reality, it's fine. I mean, the material of it is what we call Maya. But the order of reality is what we call Mithya. It means that Mithya means you can't categorize this experience that we're having as being... having an absolute reality, which means it's always there, it's always present, it is. And you can't say it's not here either, as Tuchin. That's what we mean by mithya. It's a totally dependent for the existence it enjoys. The existence that it enjoys is satyam. That's the reality. But this whole thing comes and goes in existence. The existence is the truth of it. And the existence is my amness. I'd say this whole reality, that this whole creation enjoys existence. That means you enjoy existence. Whole creation enjoys existence. It is, it is, it is. Okay. What do you call the existence? What do you call existence? I call existence amness. My being. Okay. What is your being? What does that mean? That when you say, I am, I exist. It's the self-evident being, self-evident consciousness. It's the bottom line of all of your experience. It's what changelessly pervades any and every experience that you have without itself undergoing any change. Right? It's the constant that, it's like, I am. Swamiji will joke some, I am. It's like the kind of the raga, what do you call that? That underlying tone, you know, that never changes, the shruti. Your own being is the shruti. It doesn't fluctuate, it doesn't change, it doesn't come and go, it is always there. So just that the being that you are is always there as the constant in all experience. So now we think, well, that's because my body's always here. Yeah. And when the body goes, this is what everybody's fear, when the body goes, then this constant presence of me will go. That's why we have to do all of this work to recognize that this body itself is an object. It's an object of my awareness. It itself, you know, doesn't touch awareness in any way. It doesn't touch awareness as being something that can impact on my being in any way. And also, there's all these prakriyas, all these teaching methodologies that we have to go through so that I can actually recognize the fact of that. To differentiate the constancy of myself from all experience, from all emotions. And it's not like the experience is over here and I'm over here. is I'm the very self of all of those experiences, but I don't change and the experiences do. So where do you put the ahankara? Where do you put the I notion? That's why in this Dakshinamurti, Dakshinamurti is the one who has this mudra. Normally the ahankara, the I, goes with the body, mind, sense organ. So as long as the body, mind, sense organs are there, I'm here. But Dakshinamurti teaches with this mudra, you know, which means that this I is not dependent on the body, mind, sense organs. It is, this is the I thought, this belongs here to Brahman, to the self, you know, which is the constant. That being so, these body, mind, sense organs can die and drop, which of course it will, and nothing happens to me. Just like the meadow can come with all the people in it, and you can be a character in it. It can last for however it lasts, and then it can resolve. And nothing happens to you. You have a dream at night, you wake up, the whole dream world is gone, it's destroyed. Nothing happens to you, and you don't even feel like anything's happened. this whole world, dream world, is totally gone, that you are so committed to, being so engaged, if you have one of those real dream, you know, you're so engaged, you're so committed to it, the whole thing goes, the whole thing, the dream character in it, and nothing happens. Because, in fact, nothing happens. Because the dream maya doesn't have any independent being for something to happen. It doesn't have its own substance or its own reality or its own consciousness or its own being at all. And so when it comes and goes, even though from within it can be so intense, so many things can be going on, when it goes, nothing has happened. So that's the situation. And the thing that's kind of funny about this is that whether you have no self-knowledge or not does not affect the truth of what is. You know, and so you don't have to have self-knowledge to be Brahman. You are Brahman. But the problem is that within the creation, the person who doesn't know I am Brahman, then that person really suffers. You suffer because of the total delusion, I am and I exist and I am the whole, and then I realize, I feel that I should be the whole, and so I try to create that for myself, you know? Because I should be the whole, and here I am. This isn't right. Right? This is not what I was supposed to be. So then I try to create it so that it is how it is supposed to be. And nobody can really... People say, I'm not afraid of death. I'm more afraid of suffering, not afraid of death. Because, you know what, I think that many people can... Some people don't say that. Some people say they're terrified of death, actually. But many people say, you know, I'm not really afraid of death at all. But I think one of the reasons a person can legitimately say that is because a person can't conceive of death. It's not conceivable. Because even when you try to conceive of it and imagine it, that is actually an enlightening experience, because the more you try to conceive of it or imagine it, the more experientially present you are. You know? And so, to try to even imagine your own non-existence, the more you imagine it, the more you are. It's very hard to even get to any real feeling of that. I think just that's true for some people. I've kind of recognized that in people and in myself, that it's not something that you can have the experience of, because there is no such experience. Yeah. I also wonder what that is, too. It's like, you know, if there's with the transmigration of the soul, just on a relative level, from beginningless time, you're taking body after body after body. You know, and so that's in the DNA of the creation. That's, you know, I've often thought about that. It's got to be in the DNA of the creation and of your own, the jiva that's transmigrating. And then also Bhagavan gave us this dream, gave us imagination and dream, the dream. And that's such a clue. It's such a big clue, you know. It's almost like we are experiencing birth and death all of the time without anything happening. So.
And yet it seems constant.
Change is constant, but you're constant in the change. That's what you continually experience.
If you didn't have that constant with all this change going on, it would just be a total movement. All
there would be nobody there. Because whoever was there is already gone. Right? If consciousness had a relationship with something that is subject to change. Now the change is infinitely divisible, just like time is infinitely divisible. So you can never even find the thing that was a conscious being. It's already gone. And if you think that there was a moment in between, well, you can divide that too. Right? Because as long as it takes up time, which change requires time, that means time or change is infinitely divisible. There's no end to it. And so then try to find the moment when someone was there. You can't find the moment when someone was there if the someone has anything to do with something that changes, because change is infinitely divisible. And it's already gone. Yeah. You see the problem?
You need a constant.
Yeah, and that constant, the constant can't have anything to do with time. Consciousness can't have anything to do with time. Yeah. And it doesn't. It doesn't have anything to do with time. That's your constant experience. Is that you're the one that illumines time. Time's passing right through you, but you're not passing through it. You're there. So you just have to differentiate that, because the mind isn't. The mind relies on that reality, but it has never brought it into knowledge. That's why an Upanishad kind of holds up that mirror to you, to recognize, to put into words what is the truth of you. And that's why when you hear it, often the feeling, people will say something like, myself said, it's like somebody's putting into words what I've always known, but I've never heard it put into words. It needed to be said, but what's being said is not new to me. It's like that. It's not new to you because it is you. So it's the words are just holding up a mirror.
Would it be the same for animals then?
Animals are still the animals have the same consciousness. The conscious being that you are is the conscious being the animal is. The degree of mumukshutvam, in terms of a buddhi that goes through all this process of differentiation, doesn't seem to be there in the same degree for an animal. So their life is much more instinctual, but they still have a mind. They still have feeling and emotion and, you know, a kind of a different orientation toward the world and their thought process. Some of it we totally understand, and some we wonder, what are you thinking? what are you thinking? I think that with Tibby all the time. What are you really thinking about there? But that she's thinking, that she has feelings, that she is relating, I don't have any doubt about that. But I don't know that animals ask for and have that self, same type of self-reflective ability where they, or maybe they don't need it either. They don't get all screwed up. Or
okay.
I once had an experience with a dolphin. I was swimming with a dolphin, and you have a different experience when you look at a dolphin in the eye, and he goes back like, oh my God. Like there's somebody there that is like bigger than a cat or...
Yeah, much, yeah, I know. That's an amazing thing.
That's so exciting.
Maybe they have dolphin gurus. How do we know? dolphins are, some animals are highly, highly evolved, especially dolphins. So what is their world like? They have their own language and everything, but we don't, we're not privy to it yet. We don't know the language.
But the animals don't know that they don't know.
Pardon me?
The animals know, but they don't know that they know. So therefore, they can be taught. Their consciousness is absorbed by the objects that they are pursuing some, but you cannot address them.
They might not have a sense of differentiation, kind of like in the Garden of Eden, you know, before they recognize differentiation.
Yeah, so they cannot know that they know.
Yeah, possibly.
Otherwise, they would be humans.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah.
And they could be taught Vedanta, but they cannot. Because they know, but they don't know that they know.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I don't know what the whole truth of all of that is, but we kind of accept that. But I don't think we really know. I mean, I accept what you're saying. I don't know about dolphins and some other studies they've done for some species. They seem to have a high degree of intelligence and even language, but they haven't figured out. And also, it's a lot of problem solving, too. In a very intelligent way, and being able to communicate and plan. There's been a lot of studies with dolphins, so I don't know what's going on in the dolphin world. But just because I don't know. But really, when we're talking about Vedanta, where it's really in a human language and communicated between humans, doesn't have to be that way. Somebody figures out how to teach a dolphin, and they want to know dolphin Ramukshu, I'd be happy to. If little Tibby was a Ramukshu, I would try to teach her.
Carol, is there a West Coast version of like the ashram at Sailorsburg? And why isn't there?
There used to be. Well, it's a little bit of a complicated question, but I'll tell you the basics for us with Swamiji. Is that we ran a three-year course in 1982 up at Sandipani Sadhanalaya, which is still there. It's a beautiful ashram up in the Himalayas, but not the Himalayas,
where?
But up in Garberville.
Piercy.
Yeah, Garberville. Near Piercy, which is near Garberville. But, you know, that's like 5 hours away. And so we were able to run one course there, but it would be very hard to support that. It's just costly to support an ashram like that, whereas on the East Coast, where it's the tri-state area is really Little India, and there's a lot of this, there's an Indian population there that is able to support it. And so that's really why. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't really support two. Mm.
You know. Whereas 90, that wouldn't be 95 miles from New York City.
Yeah.
So there's just a big enough population to support it. But that's why. Whereas in India, you know, there's ashrams all over the place. Swamiji himself has really two, and then counting Nagpur, three different ashrams. But then his students all have ashrams also, so there's, and within our sampradaya there's ashrams all over the place. But here there's not the Westerners don't support ashrams in the same way, you know, that we think of, that within a kind of an Indian tradition. So I think that's a good answer. This is our little ashram.
Yeah,
I know, mini ashram. What's so neat in India, you know, in Swamiji's Swamiji kind of came in on the tail end of this, but it used to be in Rishikesh, and in the Rishikesh up in the Himalayas, if you were a sannyasi or a sadhu, you could just go stake out a place and build a little, stake out your place and build a little kutir there, and that was your place. And Swamiji did that. You know? So nice. What a beautiful little grass hut.
Well,
straw
that
hut.
Land was set aside for sannyasis, or set aside for sadhus.
Yeah, from the it was just this. It was not.
There was
not
no
even
ownership.
Yeah, but it's not even. I don't think that it was set aside. Later, it had to be that you had to talk like that, setting aside. But I think before, it's just kind of the way it was. That was the area, the Himalayas on up. You know, where because sannyasa is part of the culture, and sadhus, and it's a very respected part of the culture, so there was a room for it, and it was honored. I mean, just imagine if we had that here. You know, that there were like Himalayas here, that, you know, if you wanted to live that type of a lifestyle and just be on your own, that would be all right. You could, there's a place you could go and do that, and you wouldn't be arrested. As a squatter.
Move on.
Yeah, like the Big Sur area could be like that. Mm-hmm. And all the sadhus go to the Sur. You know?
But you know, slowly but surely, things that were meant to be helpful always have a kind of a shadow side also, like they started all of these kshatriyas, you know, all the way up in the Himalayas where they would feed the sadhus, so sadhus could go and get, you know, like their two chapatis and dal. Well, that never used to be. It used to be where a sadhu would go and go to something like three houses a day, you know, for bhiksha. And that's how they would eat. But then some people who wanted to help the sadhus put up all these kshatriyas where they had a place to go to get the food. And then that started a different type of relationship with sannyasa, you know, where could, instead of it's being just between you and Ishwara, you know, now it's between you and the kshatriya. I don't know. Just a little, becomes a little, it becomes more, I don't know.
Institutionalized.
It institutionalized a little bit. Or it didn't used to be that initially. In fact, there's stories where teachers in the Himalayas used to tell their students, walk back down to the tip of Madras, Chennai, and back, and then when you get back, I'll teach you. Walk down, walk there and back with nothing. When you get back, then I'll teach you. So
why?
That you, huh?
Why?
So that you could appreciate that you don't need anything to be taken care of. Yeah. It's a good experience. Anyway, enough of that. Let's stop.